The divine has manifested itself in all the various forms of nature. It's God equally present in a rock, in a turtle, in an insect, in a human being, in an enlightened master, in a star. God is equally in everything. He's not more in some things than others. Omnipresence implies equal presence everywhere. But what makes it possible for some people to manifest more of him than others? There is, as it were, sheaths, or a kind of a cloak, a succession of these sheaths, or koshas as they're called in Sanskrit, that obscure the inner knowledge of the soul. And thus, a turtle, let's say, since we did say, is not able to feel the way you and I feel, is not able to perceive things the way you and I perceive them. Even though that knowledge is there, it's been covered up with the veils of delusion. And those veils are progressively removed as we advance spiritually. This advancement takes place automatically on an animal level over a period of many lifetimes. In the Indian scriptures, they say it takes 5 to 8 million lives for the soul to reach the human level after having once been brought into matter. And this gradual evolution is, as I said, automatic until we reach the human level, after which there is enough freedom in the consciousness of man to be able to do something about his own salvation. He has enough of those sheaths removed so that the light begins to shine more clearly on his consciousness, where before it's sort of like having a succession of curtains, and if you remove some, you begin to see the light, but you don't see very clearly, and it's only when you've taken away all the curtains that you can see the countryside just as it is. And so also with these sheaths, coming to the human level, as it says in the Indian scriptures, God sleeps in the minerals and dreams in the plants and begins to wake up in the animals, and in man is fully awake. But fully awake means only in man, only in that man who has discovered his true humanity, who has fulfilled and realized all the potentials that he has given as a human being. It is possible for man to achieve cosmic consciousness, but the vast majority of men don't have that. And what they have is just enough of this awakening to be able to go forward, but many people take that same power of awakening to go backward. They have the freedom to move on their own, and they automatically tend to go back toward the things that they are accustomed to. And it takes a long time, many, many lifetimes, before the soul begins slowly to uncover enough of these sheaths to be able to perceive its own essence. Now, the most important of these removals, these sheaths that we need to take away, is that which prevents us from being able to feel love, because it's love that takes us forward on the path. It's by the power of love that we advance spiritually. Without that power, we can't advance at all. I'd like to read a passage from Sri Yukteswar's The Holy Science. This heart's natural love is the principal thing to attain a holy life. When this love, the heavenly gift of nature, appears in the heart, it removes all exciting causes from the system and cools it down to a perfectly normal state. And invigorating the vital powers, excretes all foreign matters, the germs of diseases, from it by natural ways, perspiration, etc., and thereby makes man perfectly healthy in body and mind, and enables him to understand the proper guidance of nature. When this love becomes developed in man, it makes him able to understand the real position of his own self, as well as of others surrounding him. With the help of this developed love, man becomes fortunate in getting the godlike company of the divine personages and is saved forever, in other words, of the Guru. Without this love, man cannot live in the natural way. Neither can he keep company of the fit person for his own welfare. He becomes often excited by the foreign matters taken into his system through mistakes in understanding the guidance of nature, and in consequence, he suffers in body and mind. He can never get any peace whatever, and his life becomes a burden. Hence the culture of this love, the heavenly gift, is the principal thing for the attainment of holy salvation. It is impossible for man to advance a step towards the same without it. And so, the most important thing that we need to learn is this heart's natural love. And the point that Sri Yukteswar makes in this is that it comes automatically when the conditions that prevent its expression are removed. So we see that there are two aspects to it. This is the negative one, that you remove those things that prevent you from being able to feel that love. And the other, of course, would be the positive one, striving to develop that heart's natural love in ways that we want to talk about this morning. The negative aspect of removing these conditions is all tied in with the ego. The ego, or we could put it this way too, that when the desires of the heart, because in man this capacity for love is already there, unfolded to a certain extent, but when those desires of the heart, all of them sending out energy from the heart to many different things, when these desires are expressed in countless different ways, then what we find is that the capacity for giving ourselves wholly to one thing or another becomes so diluted as to be powerless. A person who has too many desires, a person who tries to do too many things, is interested in too many things, he finds that he doesn't have the power to accomplish anything really well. It's only if we can learn to really concentrate our energies in one direction that we can grow effectively in love. And the other aspect of it is that if we use the mind too much, the intellect can kill the heart. The consciousness of man, we have two basic organs of knowing as far as our human nature goes. The one is reason, and the other is feeling. If we go too much toward reason, we find that this overcomes, this suffocates the feeling of the heart. If we learn to direct our heart toward the reason, if we don't divorce the two, then it is possible for us to have that kind of balance where each one helps the other. Reason, Master said, devotion, or rather, he said, needs to be kept in a state of reason, because otherwise it becomes fanaticism. We need to have the heart's natural love, but it can't just be a sort of an outpouring of emotion. What is the difference between feeling and emotion? First of all, feeling, in the context that we're discussing now, means calm as opposed to excited. Excited feeling is emotion. Without the excitement, feeling automatically aspires upward toward the spiritual eye. And when we speak of feeling on the spiritual path, in this context of feeling versus emotion, what we're speaking of is calm feeling directed upward toward the brain and toward the highest chakras. We need to learn how to direct that energy upward from the heart. We need to learn how to remove those conditions that prevent us from feeling that energy. Some of it has to do with technique, some of it has to do with right living. All of it in the last analysis has to do with understanding who we really are and what we're here for. The ego masquerades as the self. And as long as we've got this consciousness of ego, we have this thought of separation from the infinite, which is our true self. And as long as we have this sense of separation, we have the impulse from the ego to go outward toward things. The first problem that people have is the inability to feel at all. This is the state of unenlightenment. But once that feeling is developed, then the problem comes to learn how to direct that feeling in such a way as to help us and not tie us down, because that very feeling, which can help us to rise toward God, can also, and in fact is also, our greatest obstacle on the spiritual path. Infatuation with things, with people, with circumstances, the energy of the heart going outward instead of inward and upward. So it's important to develop this feeling, but it's also important to learn not to allow that feeling to escape with us, to run away with us, and carry us again and again into delusion. This happens very easily on the path, unfortunately. People develop a certain amount of love, and before they know it, they're becoming infatuated with the world and forgetting God. This energy in the heart can go either upward or downward, and it's very important to take this energy and always try to direct it upward toward the brain. In this way, it becomes freed. Now, we're living in a culture where the feeling of the heart has been almost consciously and deliberately put down. We see how, when the heart's feelings go downward and outward, how we can be prejudiced. How, because we want something to be so, we think that it is so. And we become blinded to the realities. We don't see clearly what they are. We see them through this sort of veil of our own making. And so the whole teaching of science, the whole attitude of philosophers, the whole attitude of those people who have been dedicated to finding truth has always tended to be sort of like the Stoics who tried not to feel in order to be free. And this attitude is quite common in science, where they feel that the only instrument for really perceiving the reality of something is the reason. So with this reasoning faculty, they try rigorously to exclude any kind of heart's feelings. You will notice that many people of scientific bent have very flat chests. It's a curious fact. By the way, I'm wearing this heart because I'm talking about devotion today. Annie stuck it on me yesterday, and I thought, oh, why not? It's a good subject. It's a curious fact that many people who are over-intellectual have very flat chests. The rib cage is sort of hollow. It indicates lack of feeling. As the feeling becomes more robust, the chest tends to become fuller also. It's interesting how the body reflects the consciousness. And the more you understand of yourself, the more you can see just at a glance where people are spiritually or in their inner nature. You can see at a glance whether they go more by feeling or more by intellect, whether their feeling is properly awakened or just sort of spilling out in the wrong way toward the world, whether their intellect is clear or muddy, and so on. I read a book the other day by somebody who he was talking about the lost Christianity. And it's a subject that was a little too big for his own state of enlightenment, which was not very much. And it was a brave attempt, but it was probably better that he didn't publish, just wrote. What you could see in the writing was that he was just sort of one of these intellectuals who go in circles, so intelligent that they can't really come to any point, because they're always saying this, on the other hand this, but then, and so. And they're always just going in this sort of spinning circle. And the heart enables you to go straight to the point. You just aren't interested in all these extraneous things. You want to know what is true. So the trouble with the excessively rationalistic approach is that it paralyzes action. It paralyzes progress. It prevents one from, it's like, as I've often said, like knowing like living next door to a famous restaurant and knowing the menu and knowing everything about how they cook it, knowing that it's good, but not being hungry enough to go and eat. So you can know. I have several friends, two or three friends, who are fun to be with. I enjoy their company. I enjoy talking philosophy with them because they're very intelligent. And in their intelligence, they're very perceptive, but they aren't on the path. They can see all the reasons for being on the path, but they can't, their hearts aren't in it yet. And it'll take them a while to get into it. It's more fun talking with people like that than it is with devotees who only go by heart. Because after all, for instance, there was this devotee in India that I knew. Everything that I would say to him, he would just smile blissfully and say, Guru, Guru. And Honestly, I much preferred his company. But as far as conversation went, you might say he was a washout. I don't in any way mean to put it down. I'm only trying to explain how it can be fun to talk with people who don't understand yet in the right way because they have such clear minds. But they don't. It hasn't yet been applied to the heart. I would much rather be somebody who couldn't understand philosophy and only understood that the one thing that matters in life is union with God. I'd much rather be like that. God has given me a mind that's very inquisitive, interested in things, and so with this kind of mind, I find a rapport with other people who have it, but I'm not interested in that. What really interests me is this quality of the heart. What we see in particularly in this country, if you go, for example, down to Mexico and feel the vibrations there and then come back into the United States, it's really quite surprising the difference. This country is a kind country. It does have a lot of heart quality. But on the other hand, it's too intellectual, too mental. And you can feel that contrast when you come from a place where there is more emotion. Now, does that mean that they are more open to it there than here? No, not really. But they could be. If they had the interest that way, they have the heart quality that they could direct in that way. Actually, America is a very spiritual country. But this is its greatest defect, is its tendency to think too much, read too much, talk too much, and be too rational, thinking that everything has to be approached through mental doubt. Doubts are useful up to a point. Beyond that, they become an obstruction. Useful up to the point of being able to weed out those things that are false more easily so that you go in the right direction. But after that, you should keep going in a straight line. I've noticed that it's interesting talking in different countries where individuals will always be individuals, and there are some people who rise above the culture that they were born into and are not particularly representative of any country. This is the way we all ought to be. But these influences are there, and to some extent we tend to express them. I've noticed in England, for example, it was very curious when I was in SRF. The places where we had the most members outside of America were Ghana, West Africa, and Germany. Ghana, I don't know enough about the Africans, so I can't say, but I presume that it's because they have a lot of heart quality. And Germany, because they have a lot of willpower. But you would expect that England, which is one of the few countries outside of this country, or the North American continent, where English is well known, you'd think that England would have had many members. It had very few. And when I've lectured in England, I found the same thing, that there is a tendency there to sort of expect the worst, and I have to prove otherwise. And when I finally proved otherwise, and I'm exhausted doing so, they go home satisfied. Well, all right. So it wasn't a total waste. But I haven't converted them to what I'm trying to do, which is to their own selves. So in that country, we found not many members. Italy has been coming up very much, both in SRF and in connection with Ananda, because they have this heart quality. And in the whole history of the Christian church, look how many saints there have been in Italy. One obvious reason is the external one, the fact that they're so close to Rome that they're better known, and so naturally they're going to be canonized, where somebody who's a saint in Germany might not be known and might not be canonized. That's a superficial reason, and it certainly is part of the picture. But there's more to it than that. Any country that were to produce a St. Francis, it would have an impact, wouldn't it? Italy has produced many St. Francises, many such souls of great devotion and great dedication and high spiritual attainment because of that quality of devotion. And so, if there weren't that many in Italy, I think that it was probably because the autobiography at that time hadn't yet been translated into Italian. But we see in these different countries this this quality of the heart is still the most important thing of all. United to that is the quality of willpower, which you find so typically expressed in the Germans, killed by that quality of excessive rationalism, which you find in England and to some extent in America, because we are sort of, although we have so many countries represented here, still basically this is an Anglo-Saxon culture. And I remember when I first came to this country, how difficult it was for me to overcome the inhibition to express my feelings. It almost seemed in bad taste to express my feelings. And gradually, this country being somewhat more open that way, I learned to. Well, we need not be ashamed of our feelings. We need not feel that they are in some way that they only lead to delusion or error. That in fact, the more we can learn to express these feelings in ourselves, not necessarily outwardly, but to express them from the heart, the more we'll be able to grow toward the divine. Now, what is devotion? It's only partly the feeling of the heart. It means more than that, an absolutely one-pointed intention. That you know what you want in life and you don't want anything else. It takes a long time to develop that. And the delusion of the mind is such that it pulls you into the ego very easily. For example, a person will feel devotion, and before he knows it, he's wanting other people to see his devotion, which is to say he's becoming proud of his devotion, and is also to say that he's not really devoted. He's desecrating his devotion. Whom is he devoted to? If he wants other people to see how he's feeling, doesn't this mean that he's devoted to them and their opinions? It takes a long time to bring the heart to the point where it absolutely knows that the only one it wants to please is God. The only one it wants to impress is God. The only person he wants to find is God. It takes a long time to work this out, even after coming on the path, even after being on the path for a long time. Other things come in, other habits, other desires, other impulses. One time I remember Norman, a brother disciple of mine, had what he thought was a vision, maybe it was. Anyway, he saw himself on Lemuria 80,000 years ago as a disciple of Master. And I was horrified at this. I thought, my God, 80,000 years and you're still in this delusion? So with considerable discouragement one time, I said to Master, have I been your disciple for thousands of years? And he said, it's been a long time, that's all I'll say. I said, does it always take so long? He said, yes. Desires for this thing, that thing, take one away again and again. In other words, it takes a long time. You're very blessed to be on the path, and you don't know how many times you've been on the path before, but once the desire is firmly implanted for liberation, you won't lose it. And Master promised us that if we try hard enough, we can find our freedom in this lifetime. But that need to really know what you want in your heart, that is what devotion is. Not just a nice feeling, a warm kind of sentiment. It's much more than that. It's this absolute intention, absolute longing for union with God, absolute desire to please only God. But it does originate in the heart, because delusion originates in the heart. So the way out of delusion has to begin with the heart. The heart's likes and dislikes, the heart's attachments and aversions, all of these things are what keep us bound to the world. The thought that I like this or I don't like that, I like this person, I don't like that person, I want this, I don't want that. All of this, all of the likes and dislikes and the fierce attachments that develop in the heart, these are the things that keep us bound to the cycle of reincarnation. How are we to get out of that? We're talking of devotion, and yet we're also talking of a state of consciousness that implies very much a withdrawal of feeling, in a sense, doesn't it? If you really want to become free from delusion, You've got to become what to the worldly mind would seem cold, and yet it isn't cold at all. It means being centered in yourself and directing all your heart's love toward the divine. The more you can do that, the more you will achieve this kind of freedom. To love people as people is not liberating unless those people themselves are liberated, and through your love for them, they can help you. It's liberating also in another way, that by loving people and by loving things, we develop this love, but we must always try to turn the love of the heart upward toward God. It's only then that it will really be a means of helping us to achieve freedom. The meannesses of the heart are what Sri Yukteswar talked about. He listed those in his book, The Holy Science. He said, hatred, shame, fear, grief, condemnation, race prejudice, pride of pedigree, and a narrow sense of respectability, which are eight, are the meannesses of the human heart. By removal of these eight obstacles, magnanimity of the heart comes in, and this makes man fit for the practice of meditation, of asana, pranayama, pratyahara, etc. These practices enable man to satisfy his heart by enjoying the objects of senses as intended for the domestic life. In other words, it's not wrong to enjoy the objects of the senses so long as we direct the enjoyment upward toward the divine. What are these? Hatred, shame. Hatred would mean intense aversion, obviously, but he doesn't mention the affection, he doesn't mention attraction, because he's speaking of turning that attraction upward toward God. So hatred is that which pushes away, and what we need to do if we are to achieve freedom is expand the heart's feelings into an awareness of oneness with all beings. We are infinite in our true nature, and anything that cuts us off from that infinity, anything that tells us that we are small, anything that tells me that I'm separate from you, is that which makes the heart small, and in that smallness it's incapable of love, incapable of expressing that love for the divine. So hatred, or excluding people from our circle of affection, this is absolutely the wrong way to go. We're talking about the need here, to bring it onto a practical plane, the need to become centered in the self, the need not to become emotionally entangled with the world, and yet we have to not develop that attitude that you see so often in devotees, of indifference toward others, of feeling that other people's problems aren't their problems. I am reminded of this one teacher who told his disciples that if they saw somebody in a ditch with a broken leg who couldn't get out of the ditch, that you shouldn't help that person out of the ditch, because that would be interfering with their karma, with that person's karma. Well, that's of course absurd teaching. Many times I've seen devotees on the path, they get a little taste of the inner joy, the inner peace, and before you know it, they're acting cold toward other people. This isn't the right way to be. We have to learn to include others in our affection, not to exclude them. The very act of renunciation is to embrace the world rather than be too attached to just a small family. You renounce the small in order to embrace the large, and embracing the large, you also embrace the small. All becomes a part of the love that you feel. So when you express this devotion to God, it means to be able to see God in others, not to repel them and say, absolutely only I think of God. Embrace them in the thought of God. Enjoy all things with the joy of God. The negative approach to life is it kills the heart's love. People who develop this cold attitude, and it comes to every devotee on the path, he gets a little bit of inwardness and immediately he begins to feel that this world is a delusion. It's sort of like Master at Tarakeshwar, when he first went to visit Ram Gopal Mazumdar, and he wouldn't bow before that round stone, the altar in that temple. And as a result, he was misled the next day into going the opposite direction from Ranbajpur, where Ram Gopal lived. And later Ram Gopal admonished him, scolded him, and said that God is outside as well as inside. And it's true we have to find him first inside, but we should also be willing to bow before his shrines and to see him objectified everywhere in nature. So this is the attitude that the devotee needs gradually to develop. Otherwise, what happens is that he develops spiritual pride. And this is, again, one of the pitfalls on the path and that which creates egotism, and it's one of the meannesses of the heart also. Then, shame. What does he mean when he speaks of shame? Remember that passage in the autobiography of a yogi where he said, "Forget the past. The past lives of all men are black with many shames, but everything in future will improve if you make the right spiritual effort now." In other words, shame is, in a sense, that by which we hypnotize ourselves by our mistakes. I remember this lovely thing that I mentioned in the path that Taramata said when she left Mount Washington to get married. And later she came back, and somebody said, "After leaving this monastery like this, how dare you show your face here again?" And she said, "Do you want me to worship my mistakes?" A very good answer. Shame is worshiping your mistakes. It's accepting the past as your reality. You are a child of God, and neither good nor bad that you do is really yours. You have simply acted. Always try to act in the best way, but don't allow yourself to be enclosed by the thought that I am evil or I am wrong. Again, shame means the limited human view of life that says that some things are bad and other things are good, you're ashamed because you break some convention and so on. Realize that in the divine, there it just is. We take too narrow a view of right and wrong. Somebody was telling me the other day about how because he didn't eat in the right way, in other words, this is one of our Italian friends, he visited the home of some wealthy people and he used a spoon to pick up his spaghetti the way some people do, you know, twirling against the spoon. Well, this is not done in the best of circles. And they sort of looked at him very coldly. This you find in every culture, that some ridiculous rule like that becomes something that is terribly important to some people who have nothing better to do with their lives. And to allow little things like that, to allow your life to be ruled by such inconsequential things, is one of the things that prevents people from being able to grow. When Saint Teresa of Avila went to stay for a time in the home of a noble lady, her comment later was that we think of these aristocrats as being free because they have so much power, but they're much more bound than the average person because they have so many little rules that they have to follow. And just all the little tiny rules of etiquette and so on. Well, we need to learn to be more just totally natural within ourselves, to act much less from society's expectations and much more from the heart. If St. Francis were to come into the average, let us say, Presbyterian or Episcopalian church on Sunday, where everybody is dressed well, and he comes in dressed in rags, they probably would do their best to put him out, gently perhaps, but firmly, because this is not done. Well, for heaven's sake, what is done? Isn't love the most important thing of all? Isn't that spontaneous devotion much more important than coming to church in a coat and tie and beautiful dress? And it used to be that they'd wear beautiful hats, and that seemed to be the main reason for going, to show off the new one. And all these outward regulations, it's good sometimes to break them. Master, one time, to break the nuns of some of this quality, had them eat watermelon on the side of the road, but really eat it, I mean like this. It was getting all over their dresses and everything. And for a while they were just terribly embarrassed to think, gosh, everybody's seeing us making a mess of ourselves. But he insisted. And I hope he broke through it for some of them. Another time, he had them doing the energization exercises on the side of the road. And there they were doing these things, and all the passersby staring at them. And he said, why worry? They're only looking at it because they don't do it. They only think it's strange because they don't do it. It reminds me of a time, just incidentally, when I was staying in Mexico for a vacation, and an American in the room next to mine came over to talk to me, and I was standing in my doorway doing the energization exercises. His eyes were getting bigger and bigger. I didn't explain, I just talked while I kept going like this. Finally, he said, oh, you're exercising. But in fact, it's very good self-discipline to do things that you know people are going to think absolutely bizarre and don't bother to explain. You don't have to satisfy them. You have to satisfy your own conscience. So whatever, what you do, if you know that you're doing the right thing, let them think what they want to. It's good discipline because it helps to get rid of this consciousness of shame. One time, Bernard, Master did this for Bernard one time, that I guess some of the ladies in the congregation had been saying how nice Bernard would look in a turban. So Master decided that he'd really help Bernard out of this thought. And so there was a big function, and Master put him in a turban. And he tied the turban himself, but he tied it very badly, so that it kept sort of falling off on one side and then falling off on the other, and he had to keep pushing it up and hold. Looked absolutely absurd. Sometimes it's good for you. I don't say, you can go too much in the opposite direction too. One time Master met a man in Phoenix who was dirty and disheveled and just wearing rags, and Master said, what are you dressed like that for? And the man said, I am a renunciate. And Master said, but you're bound again unto disorder. He didn't want us to walk around in dirty clothes and torn clothes in the name of non-attachment. If you have attachment to looking elegant, then it might be a good thing just as a corrective. But once you've done that, it's just as easy to be attached to torn vestments as it is to looking elegant. Some people almost take pride in looking like tramps. And this Master didn't want. He said, you can dress perfectly well. Ananda Mohima used to tell this to her disciples, you don't have to wear torn clothes, just in the name of non-attachment. We have enough money to get you decent saris and so on. So dress nicely, if only as a compliment to other people. I sometimes go up to total strangers and thank them for wearing what they're wearing, because it's such a pleasure for others. And I was pleased the other day. I went into a record shop and the clerk came over, and then in the middle of our talk, she said, oh, what a nice jacket. Well, we don't see these things ourselves, but if it gives pleasure to others without giving pride to ourselves, then it certainly adds to the beauty of the world to behave nicely. The important thing is not to do it because of shame. Not to do it because you'd be ashamed not to. Not to do it because you don't want to stand out. Those are egoic reasons. Do it simply as a courtesy. Do it out of consideration for others. It's no fun having people walking around just looking dirty and disheveled all the time, and besides which, it attracts wrong kinds of vibrations. I remember the comment that Swami Chidananda made one time when he was here in 1970, when the community was very new and people were they weren't very careful about what they did. So there were tin cans and tools and all sorts of junk lying around the farm when we took him around. And his comment was that this attracts lower entities. If you want to attract higher entities, then you have to keep things neat. And he's quite right. If you want to attract higher states of consciousness, you need to be clean. You need to be right, but not in the name of shame. Just in the name of being an instrument for a higher power, which is, after all, neat, orderly, harmonious, beautiful. In that sense, there needn't be ego at all. So shame is another of the meannesses of the heart that he said that we need to overcome. Fear means you're trying to protect something that isn't you. So in your fear, you're again separating yourself from other people. Grief means accepting as a reality that which is not really real. Whatever happens in this world, we shouldn't go to pieces over it. Nothing's really that important. It's all a dream. If we can keep that consciousness, we need to develop the opposites of these traits. In other words, the opposite of grief is equanimity. The capacity for grief begins also in the mental tendency to be overjoyed. We should be neither overjoyed nor grief-stricken at whatever happens to us. Always just be even-minded and cheerful. This is the attitude of the yogi, even-minded and cheerful. Then he said, condemnation, this tendency to judge other people. Actually, it's a very interesting rule of life that anything that you judge in others, you're going to have to suffer yourself, undergo yourself. This is a law. If you criticize something in others, you will have to experience what it is you're criticizing in order to teach you that lesson that everything is divine. Everything comes from God. People who devote their energies to judging other people are those very people who are drawn into the delusions that they judged, but also the very reason they judge is because they have the germ of that delusion already. Otherwise, it wouldn't matter. Anything that you dislike in other people, remember, it's something in you that's making you dislike it. Otherwise, you could accept it, just as you accept the thunder and the lightning and the fact of disease in the world and so many things. If somebody upsets you, try to think, what's wrong with me that makes me upset? And as long as you keep objectifying your feelings towards others, then you won't be able to achieve that kind of freedom of the heart that develops the heart's natural love. Race prejudice is another important, very important distinction. And race prejudice means, you see, the real races of man are not just black and white and yellow and brown. These are biologically the races of man. But the true races of man are something much subtler than that. The true races are the different levels, the Shudra, or the peasant type of consciousness, the Vaishya, the merchant type of consciousness, the Kshatriya, the warrior type of consciousness, the Brahmin, the priestly type of consciousness. These stages of evolution, these are the real races. And you find that people who are on the same plane will have something in common with each other, no matter what their race or nationality, that they won't have with people of their own biological race, even if they're in the same family. This real race prejudice is a more important one. But first, the race prejudice that we find, for instance, between whites and blacks in this country, thank heaven it's being worked out to the point where people don't seem to have it that much. Nothing like what it was, say, 20 years ago. Because it's based on a total delusion. As Master said, they talk of white and black. If they take the skin off, they're all red. The interesting thing here is that anything that you hate, just as anything that you judge, anything that you hate, you're going to have to go through. Many blacks today who have a big complex are whites, and were whites in their last life who hated blacks and therefore had to be born as blacks. And now they have this same attitude toward the whites. But you never get out of it by hatred. You never get out of it by judging other people. You've got to bring yourself to the point where you see that all are children of God equally. And there's no better or worse. We need to do those things that will help to overcome those thoughts in our own minds. The class prejudice is not so strong in this country because anybody from any class can rise to be the president of the largest corporation or the president of the country and so on. There's much less of that kind of class prejudice that that you see in other countries. In some countries, it's really hard to break out of. I grew up in a culture where class prejudice is very strong, and I remember my outrage when I came to this country at being put in the kitchen to eat. That's where the cook eats. It was unthinkable that I should be on that level. And it took me quite a while. I used to have to really work at... I'd go into restaurants where truck drivers hobnobbed and so on and mix with them deliberately to get rid of what I knew perfectly well was this delusion that was born, that was bred into me by having been brought up in a society where that consciousness is so strong. I admired the attitude here in this country of equality, but I had to develop that consciousness in myself. We've got to work, if we have any such thing, to get rid of them, because these are meannesses. Again, the race differences that are the real races, these different stages of evolution, we have to understand that all people are trying. All people are on the road to perfection. And if they're below us, they'll get here sooner or later. Who knows how long it's taken us to get where we are. And there are others, certainly, who are above us. And we'll get to be where they are, too. We shouldn't feel badly that we haven't gotten there yet. It's all a long series of grades that we go through before we can achieve freedom in God. So the meanness of race prejudice, the pride of pedigree, this comes under the social respectability angle that I was talking about, thinking, oh, I belong to such and such a family. It doesn't really matter. You belong to this family for a short time. But in your next life, who knows where you'll be? It's all so uncertain. Master wrote a poem about one time being an emperor and another time being a beggar. And when he was an emperor, everybody was praising him and flattering him. And when he was a beggar, the world walked by completely unheeding that he was starving. And he realized that we won't find security anywhere except in God. So all these experiences need to bring us to the point where we see that the family we're born into doesn't matter. The country we're born into doesn't matter. We're not American. We're not male or female. We're not of this particular race or that one. We are children of God. That's all we are. And the more we live that way and the more we see other people that way, the interesting thing is that when you look at people with that consciousness, they seem to respond in kind. I've noticed this so often. It isn't normal for perfect strangers to smile at you. But I've noticed that when I look at strangers with this thought that they are my own, that even if I'm not smiling, they smile at me. They somehow feel something that makes them feel comfortable about smiling at me. You take, for instance, strange women. I mean, women who are strangers, not necessarily strange women. The last thing our culture would induce in them is to smile at a strange man. But I found that even women will smile, even if I'm not smiling at them. Just sort of, they'll sort of have an effort to smile and then, oh my, maybe I shouldn't, kind of thought. But that kind of thought that, oh, this is somebody who's my own, because I've put out that thought. You'll find that the more you live in that consciousness, the more the world begins to treat you as its own too. The world will welcome you according to the way that you treat it. And if you love it, it will love you. If you ignore it, it will ignore you. And you saw that principle operative in Master's life when he refused to bow to God in the outward form of that altar. As a result, the world treated him with a kick, because he wouldn't give his energy to the world, saying, no, I keep it only for my inner self. Therefore, the outer law, he'd followed the inner law, but the outer law deserted him. Rather, it went against him. It didn't merely refuse to tell him where Ran Bhajpur was, it told him it was in the opposite direction. There's a lot of truth in that kind of story. There's so many things in the autobiography which, if you meditate on, you can come up with all the philosophy you need. You don't need big books on it. Just live through the examples that he gave us. So if you live, if you don't follow the law in some particular way, then in that way the law will go against you. And if you follow the law in the way of love, then the law will love you. The world will love you. The world will support you. Give to the world, and the world will give back to you. This is a very important part in the development of devotion. And I think I've covered these well enough. A narrow sense of respectability ties in with what I've been talking about, too. But it all comes back to, if we can get rid of the thought of ego, if we can get rid of the thought of self, then we will be able to really unfold the heart's natural love. I remember somebody who was here and then left for a while and later came back. But after this person had left, I remember Caroline, who had gone back to England for a while and then come back here, and she said, "Oh, she'll be back. Well, you can't, once you've tasted what the joy of serving others, there's nothing that can replace that." And it's true. Serving others is that which softens the heart and makes you more receptive to the divine through all forms. I remember when we met Anandamoyi Ma, her comment about Dayama and Anandamata and me was, "They are soft." This was a compliment. They are soft, meaning they're open, they're trusting, they don't feel that they've got to defend themselves. Well, if you can overcome fear, if you can overcome doubt, if you can overcome these meannesses of hatred and shame and so on, if you can really open yourself to others and know that God will take care of you in some way, you don't have to protect yourself. Look how different that attitude is from the average worldly attitude, which thinks that it's always got to fight to protect its own rights. And the least little thing that you do that seems to even hint that you might be threatening their rights, and they snarl like a pack of wolves. If you can have that kind of trust toward everyone, and it can only be born, see, there are two kinds of trust. One is born of ignorance and the other of wisdom. What makes us love little animals? Their littleness surely isn't the real answer. If you think of a baby elephant, it's bigger than you are, and still it's cute. And I think it would be cute even if you'd never seen a big elephant. Because there's just something in the eyes of the young that appeals to all of us. What is it? Their trust. They haven't been clobbered yet. They haven't learned to protect themselves. They haven't discovered that life is a pretty grim show sometimes. And they haven't learned to be defensive. The more that we can keep that consciousness, the more happy we are. We're attracted to it in little babies and little animals. And you think of a little puppy, and it's, apart from its littleness, its clumsiness, its enthusiasm for all sorts of nonsense, there's that trust that makes it so absolutely winning. We know this is something we want. We know this is something that we've tended to lose. But you're bound to lose it as long as you live in an outward consciousness. Unless you're extraordinarily stupid, you very soon learn that the world is not necessarily always your friend, that there are a lot of mean people out there. There are a lot of mean people who want to do the worst by you possible, sometimes just to do bad because they see you being good. There are a lot of people like that. But I remember one man I met. I picked him up on the highway, and he gave me a long, hard luck story, and I took him to some friend's house and gave him a lunch there, asked them to feed him. And I think I had $50 in my bank account. This wasn't long after I was put out of SRF, so I didn't have much money, but I gave him half of that. And for me, that was a lot. And he said, "I'll be sure that you get it back. I don't want you to lose your faith in human nature." I said, "If I'd ever had faith in human nature, I'd have lost it long ago. I don't have faith in human nature. I have faith in God. I know he'll give it back." And in fact, it turned out that this man was not in genuine need, that he was just a con artist. And I knew that he probably was, but my feeling was that supposing he wasn't, supposing it was genuine, his need, how terrible I'd feel to think that I had let him down. And so I covered my bases by saying, I'm doing it for God anyway, it doesn't matter. I didn't mind, it came back to me a thousandfold. If we trust in the world, it will let us down. But if we trust in God, then we find a basis on which we can build total trust. Nothing can hurt us if we really love God. Then we can be soft and sweet and loving toward all, because we know that however they treat us, God is always there. And if we live in the right way, always we will come out on top in the end. This is a state of consciousness that the world doesn't breed in you, and it's something that absolutely amazes people when they see it. Most of you are like this. It's something that living in this community does to people automatically, not just because you're living with good people, but because you're developing that inner consciousness that enables you to go out and mix with any type of person and still keep that trust, because you know what it's really rooted in. And so you've had this experience, I know, of going out and meeting somebody, a stranger, let's say, at a party, and expressing this kind of openness that makes them absolutely, they don't know where you're coming from. They can't put it together. It's not the way the world is. But they do find it attractive. And the more they mix with that, the more they begin to think, gosh, that's the way to be. I've told you that St. Lin, Rajarshi Janakananda, couldn't even pronounce Sri Yukteswar's name. Siruk Tetraji, he called him. He was just in love with God. He didn't care about all these little niceties. When he talked about spiritual things, it wasn't all the deep points of philosophy. It was just how wonderful it is to love God, meditate more deeply, and just be in tune with Master. That was about his message. And that was enough, because he said it with realization. The more that you love God, and the more you allow this to be the important thing on the path, the more you will find that understanding is given to you when you need it. You will see clearly what the realities are, what the right direction is. The heart is the intuitive faculty, even more than the reason. And when the heart is really calm and in tune and uplifted, then you find that it is always guided in the way that it ought to go. Or if it makes a mistake, then it is corrected. When you've reached a certain point in your devotion, God saves you from your mistakes. You've won enough of his attention so that he won't let you go too far in the wrong direction. He'll pull you back.